It's 2:04. This is KUMD, Duluth Public Radio, streaming online at KUMD.org. I'm Christine Dean, and this is live from Studio A. And I think I've lost track of how many times we've had Charlie Parr in the studio, but it's always a great time. Thanks so much for finding time for us today, Charlie.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thank you for taking the time to have me in. I appreciate it.
Well, and those chances, I mean, you do so many shows now. More than 200 a year, I think, something like that.
Certain years have been up to in the high 200s. Mm-hmm. Other years have been, you know, slower.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have you have a new album out. We'll be talking about that in just a minute. But like I said, I like to get you in here when you're doing that Wednesday residency at the Cedar. What do you want to get started with here, Charlie?
Well, I'll play a song from the new record. This is called Love is an Unraveling Bird Nest. I even got the words because there's more words in this song than I usually write for songs, so I'm still nervous about forgetting some of them. Let it rain, my house won't collapse. Let the wind blow just as hard as it likes. We'll hunker down and watch between the boughs. Bend and sway with the storm, and in the morning we'll see the sun. In the winter we'll all be gone. I'll fix the broken door when we come home and gather up all the unraveled parts and put them right again and sweep away the leaves, all of the dying snow, all of the dying snow. Love's an unraveling bird nest falling to straw upon the ground, carried by the wind until it's scattered all around. Now you might never notice it, but when it's forever gone, love's an unraveling bird's nest falling to straw upon the ground.
Charlie Parr live from Studio A, and that is the tune that opens his new self-titled album, Love is an Unraveling Bird's Nest. I'm trying to read that. Is that your handwriting on there?
No.
Okay.
I'm glad it's not. I wouldn't never be able to tell what I was writing about.
And that is, you know, I was, as I was listening to the album in preparation for this interview, I was just thinking, like, what a lovely, poignant song that is. Where did that one come from?
Don't know.
Okay. Good answer. and I also, as I was listening, I was kind of enjoying the flow of the album because it starts, you know, on that kind of poignant note, but then a couple more songs in and you're stealing a sailboat. So, you're going along for the ride while someone is stealing a sailboat.
Yeah. I mean, you know, songs are funny. That's, you know, Bird's Nest song, I really don't know kind of where some of that stuff comes from, but, you know, it's been, clear to me for a few years now that there's no such thing as, for me, there's no such thing as a song that doesn't have a fair amount of autobiography in it, including, you know, on Stealing a Sailboat. But it's that one is, you know, one of those ones that I feel maybe has more than I realize, but it's hard to tell because, you know, I thought I was thinking about birds. And I might have been thinking about something else, you mm-hmm. know, but I'm fairly, you know, uncertain of what the process of my brain really are most of the time.
And that's okay.
It's rolling along.
And the music just kind of gets you through that process and then people interpret it as they wish.
Yeah. I mean, once it's gone, it's their song now. It's not much to do with me. You know, mm-hmm. I was interested in it when I was writing it, what it might mean to me. Now it's not mine. It's out in the world. It belongs to whoever wants to listen to it now. And I only get to have it again when I get to perform it, because then I get to rewrite it. You know, this recording is not much to do with how I feel about it now.
Really?
Yeah.
It's just
songs are never written and they're never done. They are interesting as long as I can keep playing them and keep performing them and keep messing with them. But I'm not like a painter of portraits, for example. You know, you paint someone's portrait and then you give them to them or to someone else has it. They take it to their house and they hung it up, and now you can't get to it. You know, you can't edit it anymore. It's really done. You know, it's not even in your possession anymore. Songs aren't like that. Songs are, you know, the record represents the way that song was on whatever that day that we recorded it was, and that was interesting. You know, we're just, like, you know, you're just trapping the process of moving air molecules around.
Right.
But that's not really the song. The mm-hmm. song is something that, you know, keeps on happening and keeps on growing. That particular song, the Bird's Nest song, hasn't been evolving as fast as some of the other ones has because I haven't played it that much because it's a more worrisome song to me. And I might not play it that much at all because
from a playing standpoint, or just from
I'm worried that it's more personal than I think.
Right. Yeah.
For me, you know, songs, especially songs that I write, there's as much, you know, emotional stuff in them as there is musical technique or whatever. Because I'm not really much of a musician, so I think in terms of like how I relate to the song emotionally mm-hmm. more than musically,
mm-hmm.
and that one is creating some issues emotionally mm-hmm. for mm-hmm. me. So,
all right. So,
that's too much for.
and then you played
are
on
we
the.
Forgetting that there are people that maybe listening.
No, I think this is wonderful. But I think that's part of kind of an interesting, interesting side effect of doing what you do. Then you come on the radio and you play it, and then somebody is asking you about it, and you have to talk about it.
Which is great, which is, you know, part of the process of understanding what
plumbers don't have to do that. I often think about that. Maybe I should start having plumbers on the radio and talk to them.
I think everybody should start to do that.
Yeah.
I mean, wouldn't it be interesting if we all, like, sat back and looked at our work and thought about
mm-hmm.
what it meant?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, plumbers have a pretty important job.
They do.
I'd like to think that a lot of plumbers think that there's a certain kind of art involved in what they do.
Absolutely.
But no one ever asked them about it.
Exactly. And what, you know, so I think about that sometimes. Like, it's, you know, it's people that are musicians that get at, you know, they not only have to do the work, but then they have to answer all these questions about it.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to bug my plumber about it, but I'd like to acknowledge that there's something more there than just, like, threading pipes together.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, how do you feel about that job?
That's good stuff.
What was going through your mind when you did that job? All right, we are on a wonderful tangent there. part of the fun of having you in, Charlie. We can go on these weird tangents. Hey, tell me about the guitar that you were just playing, because so we have a student in here who's a huge fan of yours, and she was talking guitars with you before this, and so you were talking about the I think you Were you playing the other guitar before this?
Yeah.
Okay. So, and you said you had an extra, it's a resonator guitar, which is what you generally play. And it has an extra string on it. Tell me about that. You were talking about that before the session.
Well, both of these guitars are made by the Mule Resonator Company in Saginaw, Michigan. And I got spoiled by these guys, a little tiny outfit. And that guitar that I was playing is a wooden-bodied guitar. Most of my resonator guitars are metal-bodied guitars. That one's a wooden body. It has three resonator cones instead of the usual one. It has an octaved G string. So it's got seven strings, but it's really not a seven string guitar. The extra string acts like an octave string to the G string, like on a 12 string. So you play it like a six string, but that extra string rings like a 12 string would.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that I've done it to a few of my guitars. I mean, the history of it goes back a long way. Certain blues guitar players in the 20s would modify their guitars that way. Most notably, Big Joe Williams, who ended up with nine strings on his guitar by the time he passed away. And he's one of my very favorite blues guitar players. His sound is amazing and different. Spider John Kerner is another one that his guitar during some of his early recordings and his early shows in the early 60s usually had seven strings on them, like this one, an octave G. Some of them had up to nine, and then he just moved to a 12 string, you know, and played that. But when we talked about this guitar, I asked him to try it because when I did it myself, I could never get the intonation correct enough. And Matt at Mule was able to do it, and I've had it for maybe going on a year now, and it's one of my very favorite instruments.
Nice. You mentioned Spider John, and of course, he's one of your musical heroes, and you covered him on this album, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is pretty cool.
I love John.
Yeah.
I saw him this summer. I got to play a couple times with him during his birthday celebration, his 1,000th moon celebration, and at Tony Glover's memorial, which was sad. I was happy to have been there and honored to have been included in that. But yeah, John is a cipher. You know, I don't know that. I have obviously limited experience to what other guitar players in the world are doing, but I don't know that I've ever seen a guitar player play quite just like him. And he's been doing it for a long time. Every time I see him, I'm just like thrilled into my bones to get to see him play, and the way that he plays, I can't play that way, and I don't even want to try. But it's a real comfort to have him out there in the world right now.
As you get out in the world and you're playing in far flung places, are there people that aren't as familiar with him that you have the chance to introduce him to? The music musically.
Yeah, sure there are. Unfortunately, John's trajectory and maybe wasn't as widespread as it should have been. He's one of those artists, I think you could call him criminally overlooked, And he did have a big influence on the, in the early 60s kind of, folk scare time. Even Bob Dylan, wrote about John's influence on him in Chronicles. So I think he should have probably gotten more recognition than he got. And I come across people who don't know that name and they look him up and they get it.
Mm-hmm.
Ironically, I was in the Netherlands this summer, and a lot of people did know, who Spider John is, and that was comforting.
Nice. That's great. That's very cool. What do you want to do next for us?
I'll play that song about the sailboat.
I think I saw you do that for the first time at maybe the Phil Cook show at Sacred Heart.
Right.
And I think you said it was a true story, but
nah.
Darn.
It probably is.
Okay. It's true somewhere. But it's a delightful story, and it made me smile then, and it makes me smile on the album. So
I don't want to advocate for criminal behavior, though.
I just kind of like the character. I feel like the character whose voice you're singing is kind of being taken along for the ride there. And
oh, yeah. That part's true. I feel that way a lot.
All right. Let's hear it.
Okay.
Charlie Parr.
Thank you.
says, I could sell one of those. You don't even need a key. I said, yeah.
Can't afford to float, Ed. I love that one. That is Charlie Parr live from Studio A on Stealing a Sailboat.
Yeah.
Such a fun tune.
May or may not be a true story.
Yeah, I suppose you, even if it was, you couldn't say it
you
on the radio.
It.
Yeah.
Name has been changed to protect the internet.
So this album, you recorded the whole thing in one day, long day, right?
We had to. I was going to make a live record in a studio.
Mm-hmm.
We were going to invite, have an audience come to the studio, like 40 people come to the studio and just make a record, like a live record, right in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so that I could, because I don't always feel super comfortable in studios.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought this would be an interesting way to see if I could get like the studio sound quality with the energy of people, which... You know, the thing that I like best about what I do is performing and the people, you know. So I thought, that's what I'll do. It's going to be great. We booked the time at Pachyderm, and they've got that house there. We could have, you know, a little party. People come over to the studio part. They sit down. They have the show. We would just do it like a show, you know, make it fun for the people. So they wouldn't have to hear multiple takes. It'd just be a show, you know. We'd just be recording it the whole time. Then they'd go back to the house and have hors d'oeuvres or whatever they do in the house, and then they go home. Well, I broke my shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
I had already paid for the studio time, and it was not, you know, you can't get a refund.
Mm-hmm.
And so as I was recovering from my injury, I realized I was going to have to do something. And so it just didn't feel like I could really do what I wanted to do confidently anymore. And so we went to the studio that morning, and we made this record. We almost could have had an audience there because it did go, you know, the way I hoped it would go. We did it relatively quickly. Most of these songs are first takes. There are no, it's all live in, you know, the studio. It felt okay. I think it could have been
I think it would have been better had we done it the way that I initially had planned on doing it. But I hope to come back to that idea sometime.
So how long after was this after you had hurt your shoulder? You'd broken your shoulder?
It was recorded in January. My accident was on August 3rd.
Oh, okay.
So
you were just kind of worried about
less than 6 months
how things were going
to... Well, the surgeon told me that I could expect to be recovering for anywhere between 6 months and 18 months, depending on mm-hmm. how things went.
Mm-hmm.
I did not really expect to be back, you know, at it so quickly. But, you know, I was... determined, I guess is one word to use. I was desperate, you know, when it happened. I didn't know what I was going to do.
Yeah.
I couldn't play.
And this was a skateboarding accident with your daughter, which I think is the... It's a terrible thing that it happened, but it's the most adorable thing ever.
Well, we had a great day. I mean, you know, a couple years ago, you know, I taught her how to ice skate, and she was interested in skateboarding. And, you know, when I was a kid, it was 1975... to 1977 when I was skateboarding. There was no skate parks. I didn't learn any tricks. I was lucky if I could just, like, you know, wobble my way down the road. But I went a lot of places on my skateboard in my fashion, you know, and I fell down a lot too because that's just what I did. But, you know, if I wasn't riding my bike, that's the other way I got around. So I said, I can show you the stand up, you know, turn, stop stuff. And that's what we did, and we had a great time with it. That particular day, we had been out most of the day riding our bicycles around, and we were just having a really good day. We had a great day together. I feel like we've got a really good relationship, and I just love spending time with her and my son. And we came back that day, and it was getting on towards the early part of the evening when we probably shouldn't have done anything else, but she wanted to go out skateboarding, and I thought that was the best idea I'd ever heard in my life. You know, that my daughter would come to my room and say, "You want to do something with me?" And I'm like, "Yes, of course I do."
Yeah,
every
take
single
those
time
opportunities,
I do. Yes. And I just want to make it about, yes, I want to be here when I'm here, because when I'm not here, I'm not here.
Right.
I'm out of the town. I'm out of the state. Sometimes I'm out of the country. So when I'm here, I want to be here. I want to be able to say, yes, I definitely want to go skateboarding
mm-hmm.
on the lake walk.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great up until, you know, an hour later when I was going a little too fast, you know, on my little too small skateboard from 1975 and hit some little thing that I never did see and just flew through the air, landed solidly on the top of my shoulder and just destroyed it. Broke it in several places. And could have been so much... Excuse me. Could have been so much worse.
You said, so is this the same skateboard you had when you were a kid?
Of course.
Oh, that's great. I love that part. But you still had that. And I remember that era, and, you know, skateboards were a thing. And I was always like, I want to try that. But I lived on a dirt road, so it didn't work very well.
They were hard to control. You know.
Not the longboards that you have.
Right. A friend of mine said, you should have a longboard at your age. Mm-hmm. I'm like, you know, I bristle at the words "at my age" all the time. And when I was in the ambulance, you know, it started like in the ambulance. What are you doing skateboarding at your age? In the hospital, what were you doing at your age?
Right.
You know, what is my age? And my mother and I had this conversation. She's going to be 92, you know, and she doesn't, I don't know what, she said, I don't know what a 92-year-old is supposed to act like. I've never been this old before. I'm new here. You know, this is my first day at being this old. How am I supposed to know how to act?
Mm-hmm.
You know, my reference points for how to act are all from younger people, myself at 7 or 15.
Mm-hmm.
30 or whatever, you know. So I don't know. I don't know that anybody else knows any better. I just know that, you know, if my daughter comes into my room and asks me to go skateboarding, I'm going again. She won't. But.
But you had that moment.
But yeah.
And you told me before the session, you said, you know, I don't regret that. It turned out okay.
Yeah, it turned out fine. I don't regret it. You know, what I did, you know, after it happened, and I had, you know, it was horrible because they couldn't operate, they couldn't cast it, they couldn't do anything. It was so bad and it was swollen so much. It was 7 days before I got to have it operated on. I couldn't take the pain medicine because they made me sick. So I had to sit still. So if I moved, it would hurt. So I just sat still. I slept upright, you know. And I felt desperate. I felt really desperate. But
after a couple of days of realizing that, you know, I just need to have patience, you know. And I started listening to music, and I listened to music that I had listened to when I was young, you know, and I listened to music that I'd never heard before, and I just went down that rabbit hole of, like, listening to everything and rediscovered stuff that I'd forgotten about and discovered new things that I hadn't heard before. And my kind of lifelong love affair with music was completely rekindled in that period of time. And then when I could lay my guitar in my lap style and start to play it, you know, I was thrilled beyond measure.
Because you play every day. Like, that's what you do.
Well, when this happened, I tried to remember the last time I had gone without having a day of playing the guitar, mm-hmm. or at least of picking it up and playing a couple of mm-hmm. chords on it or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't remember that day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that was the longest I've gone since I tried to start learning how to play the thing that I hadn't touched one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and sometimes it's when things like that happen, to be forced out of our normal, you know, where we are, it might be a good thing to kind of help us look at things a little differently.
I'm worried that it was lost on me because, you know, I was so desperate and singular that when I could get back to it, I went back to performing too soon. I was in a lot of pain for mm-hmm. the first month's worth of shows, but I mm-hmm. didn't even stop.
Yeah.
So I didn't learn anything new, you know. I didn't develop any other skills. I didn't work on anything other than listening to music and trying to get back to playing the guitar. So mm-hmm. I have no benefits. Mm-hmm. You know, I have no
okay.
new things.
All right. So this is pretty much it. So because this you, I mean, you've had some challenging times in your musical careers where you had to adapt to things that could have ended, you know, your ability to play.
Yeah.
And so, but it seems like,
but I know I have no other skills. I'm not I'm not well, employable. At
one
this
thing
point.
I would like to say is that you're an amazing writer, and I hadn't realized it in the press or the, you know, press release for this. They were talking about how Cheap Wine had come out of like an idea for a novel that you had, which I didn't realize. But just your writing on social media and your, you know, your songwriting, I'd read a book by you. I'm just telling you, Charlie. So God forbid it should ever happen that you can't play guitar, but
all right.
You're an amazing writer.
Well,
so
I appreciate that.
And I love your stories in songs, and I would love to, you know, see them on the page as well.
Thank you.
What do you want to wrap up with here?
Maybe I'll play Magwheels. The first car he got from his dad, it was a 62 Dodge, but it had a thrown rod, but he could pretend that it ran again, and he'd drive all around 14 miles into town. He had a Galaxy, two hubcaps and three on the tree, but in his mind it was fast, and he'd down on the gas, and he'd pop out the clutch so that the tires would squall, and he'd drive all around 14 miles into town. Kids are gone, he's left all alone, he's both old and young, and he feels misunderstood, like he did when he was 15 years old, and all
all they wanted in the world was a set of mag wheels. Mag wheels. Now he and Beth bought a van. Put a bed in the back, and they'd camp out in the pines and listen to the loons in the night. And they painted a mural on the side, but it never looked right. Still, they'd drive all around, 14 miles into town. Found some one afternoon at a garage sale in June. Well, they were aluminum slots, but the lugs wouldn't match up, and he had to leave them behind. That always bothered his mind. Thought, I guess it didn't mean very much from point A to point B. It was all that he needed, and he never drove around just 14 miles into town. When he was 15 years old, all he wanted in the world was a set of mag wheels.
Charlie Parr live from Studio A, and another new one from his new self-titled album, which actually has a picture of you on the front, which is very, well, a drawing of you.
My friend Jeff Mitchell drew that.
And he's also on the album, right?
He is. He's an extremely talented individual that I love collaborating with, a guitarist, folk guitarist and experimental guitarist. I've learned a ton from him, and a visual artist, his painting and drawing, and it's always been inspiring to me. He lives in Milwaukee now.
And he also added a little. I was listening to, I forget which tune it was, but I heard a little accordion on Linda. Who's playing that? And
he
was Jeff and some organ.
On the song, and he did a little backing vocals on one of the songs.
Mm-hmm.
Super talented.
It's kind of nice to have that little extra, you know, extra thing in there.
Yeah.
And so Jeff and then Liz Draper. So you also, of course, Mikkel and Brother Dave, who are your longtime collaborators, are on the album because it's required by law that they be.
Exactly.
Liz Draper, she co-produced and played bass. Tell us about Liz.
Liz is an extremely talented musician, bass player. She plays with a large number of different projects. I won't even try to start naming them because she's very busy. Fantastic musician, and I got lucky enough to get to collaborate with her a couple years ago, and we just hit it off musically and started playing together quite a bit. She plays on my sets whenever I can talk her into coming. She did this record and the last one with me. We also do an experimental kind of improvisational drone band together called Portal 3.
Oh, she's in that as well. Yeah, so tell me about that. You mentioned that you've been doing that and that you invited some of those folks to join you at the latest Boats and Bluegrass down in Winona, right?
Yep.
Portal 3 was there with me, and Jeff Mitchell was there on lead guitar, and we ended up with more of a rock band, I think, than we expected to have, but it was fun. Had a good time.
And you're playing electric in that, and tell me about that.
Like, I was playing an electric guitar that was built by the same people that makes these guitars, Mule. It's a steel-bodied electric guitar, which has actually been really comfortable. It feels like the guitars I normally play, and so playing electric guitar for me is challenging. I'm not used to it. That's not the thing that I was interested in. When I started to try to play guitar when I was 8, you know, going into 9 years old, I was not thinking about electric guitar. I was thinking about acoustic guitar, particularly the guys like Mance Lipscomb and, you know, guitar players like that. So I don't have a lot of experience with the instrument. And for some reason in my mind, I'm figuring, it's a guitar, you know, I got to just play it like it, but it's not the same kind of guitar that I'm used to playing. So up until the last couple of years, the lesson that I kept hearing to approach it as though it's a completely different instrument finally started to sink in. And over the last couple of years, I started to play the electric guitar, I think, a little more competently, even though I'm not anywhere close to being there yet. I have to work a lot on what I want to do with the instrument. But it's exciting to bring a new kind of, group of sounds into my life. It's not something that really seeps too much into the folky set. You know, when I'm playing the songs, these songs like I've been playing and the songs that I normally play, I still haven't found a place to put the electric guitar. But the drone project that I've been doing is all electric, and the soundscapes that we've been creating, I've found myself really interested in that kind of stuff. It's definitely different. It's so different that I think that keeps me really, really enthused by it.
Yeah, and it must be a fun challenge after all this time, you know, doing that. And there is an element of drone to what you do regularly. You know what I mean? Like some of the music that you play, that's a kind of a different.
Yeah, that's not my fault. There's a certain kind of, like, I guess now you'd call it Americana, but old-time, you know, ancient music, American primitive music, whatever the name for it is. But there's a drone that threads its way through that music just naturally. I mean, if you pick up a 5-string banjo, that extra string is your drone string. You don't change that during the course of a song. So the drone is natural to the kind of music that I was interested in when I was trying to learn how to play the guitar, or still trying to learn how to play the guitar. And so that's always interested me, is like, you know, songs that get too far away from that thread, that drone, I'm attracted less to those songs, I guess.
Mm-hmm. So it's an element that's always been there, but now you're just doing it in a very different way.
Now it's just obviously what it is.
Right. Now that's what the, yeah. Portal 3. Well, have you played up in Duluth yet?
No, we're something? Still kind of talking about that. What we've been doing is doing a lot of, like, we did some live scoring of independent film.
Oh, right, yeah.
Shows with, like, extra kind of visual features, because it's probably relatively boring to look at what's happening. But we did get a chance to do a show on Ice House's, like, Monday night. They have an improvisational jazz night. We got to do a set there, and I felt like we had accomplished what we set out to accomplish. Mm-hmm. And so we'll see.
And there is an annual drone festival down there.
We were invited
there?
To play drone, yeah. Not drones this year, but mm-hmm. but we're not all around at that time, so we're hoping that we can do it in 2021.
Nice. Well, as always, a pleasure. Charlie, I feel like I've kept you beyond your time here. I hope that's okay. I hope you don't get a parking ticket out there or anything.
Me too. No, I paid my meter.
All right. Good job. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me, Christine. I really appreciate being here.
Thank you so much, Charlie.
Thank you.
To check out, today is live from Studio A. Was produced by me, Christine Dean, with help from Kaya Breidenbach and Emma Gilhausen, with funding provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. To check out upcoming guests or to listen to previous sessions, go to KUMD.org and click on Live from Studio A under Programs. This is Live from Studio A on 103.3 KUMD. Thanks for listening.